Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
So it's 2020. We're officially in the next great decade. But I won't lie to you, it's hard to be optimistic about what the future holds.
A new report says home affordability is a growing problem for the average Canadian families.
A new study of wildfires around the world, from the Amazon rainforest to California, says human activity is raising temperatures and adding to the threat.
The job market is tough, and it's especially tough for college graduates. A huge number of them are actually working at jobs that don't even require a college degree.
If you're a millennial or a boomer or one of those rare Gen Xers, you might be able to get away with blaming this pessimism for the future on your age and life experience. But the same can't be said for Generation Z. They're the young bucks of the future, today's teens and young adults. They should be excited about the next 10 years. Keyword should. In reality, they aren't. Instead, they're being labeled Generation Anxiety. Anxiety is nothing new among young people, but Gen Z is worried about much bigger and more pressing issues than previous generations. So how much of it is justifiable? How is it affecting young people right now? And what can other generations do to be more helpful and understanding? I'm Stephanie Phillips, in for Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Johanna Chisholm is a digital producer at the Toronto Star. She looked into why Gen Z is being labeled Generation Anxiety. Hi, Johanna.
Hello, how are you, Stephanie?
I'm good, thanks. So when we first reached out to you to get you on the show, you said that this topic, you know, really interested you.
Mm-hmm.
What about this topic interested you so much?
For sure. I'll admit that it was assigned to me by an editor, so I don't want to take full credit for it. But when I was given the opportunity to sort of dig into this topic, I was gung-ho because partially previous reporting that I had done kind of focused on internet culture in youth. And so I had come across bits of anxiety in teens, in adolescents, revolving mostly around like self-harm on social media accounts. But when I was given the opportunity to sort of dig into why it is that the more broad generation is experiencing anxiety at such higher rates than other generations, I thought this is an awesome time to go big on this. And I had the space to do it and I had an editor's support to do it. So that's really why I was really interested in digging into it.
So you wrote that Gen Z is going to be remembered as this Generation Anxiety. Mm-hmm. So what does the most recent data tell us about the levels of anxiety for this generation?
There was a lot of really interesting studies that came out about this. The one that I thought was most relevant to our readers that are, you know, Toronto, Ontario focused was CAMH study that came out that saw a 15% increase in youth anxiety between 2013 and 2017. And that was in youth self-reporting. So again, there are problems with that, but that's a huge jump to see just in 5 years that teens are self-reporting that they themselves are suffering from severe psychological distress, which is characterized as either depression or anxiety symptoms. And then there was an APA study that came out from the American Psychological Association that sort of mirrored that data in American students, that it was doubling from 2010 to 2015, which is in that same sweet spot we were talking about with the 2010s being this sort of anxious decade. So that was confirming in the numbers. And then the part that I was assigned and tasked with really doing was going to the kids and the teens and actually speaking with them to find out what's going on with you guys. Not that you can really contrast it with the before, but just to get their takes on why they're feeling anxious and what's going on there.
So who did you talk to? And what did they tell you about their anxiety?
So there was a large group of teens that reached out to me. Initially, it was kind of hard getting, you know, anxious people to come forward and talk about their most intimate feelings about things. Yeah, but sure. Eventually I was able to get a hold of some teens from ages 14 to 17 who were in high school and junior high to get their sort of takes on it from the more adolescent side of things. And then I was able to get teens who were in the university level, so 20 to 23, because Gen Z cuts off at 23 in most situations. Some people push it to be 25, I think. But I think most people agree, like Pew Research Center says, 97 to 2012 is Gen Z, because you had to be, I guess, like sentient for 9/11 for that event to be characterized as millennial. Mm. And yeah, so I spoke with a bunch of different teens, all who were experiencing different kinds of anxiety and kind of different levels of awareness about it. So one student I spoke with, he didn't even really characterize his symptoms as anxiety because he didn't even really know that it was anxiety. Mm. He was just looking out at what are my prospects after I graduate? And, you know, he's an econ student at the University of Toronto, A student, really good. I'm pretty sure he's good for jobs after graduation. But even he was looking at Job Banks Canada every single day and was like, my heart just feels heavy. I was getting like migraines at the library and couldn't really like put into words why he was feeling these things. And then when someone asked him like, hey, do you think it's anxiety? He was like, oh, maybe, I don't know. Whereas other students I spoke with were very capable of putting the words to what they were feeling. So I think that also speaks to a level of awareness that's out there for yeah. young people that previously wasn't there.
Right.
And I spoke with a climate activist in high school who had some very powerful things to say for a 17-year-old that I quite honestly was blown away by. But she was sort of just explaining how, you know, she would talk to her dad about what it was like for him growing up and the contrast between what she's looking at and what he was looking at, which was, you know, buy a home, get a job, buy a home, live in the suburbs, pay off your mortgage. And she's looking at it like, how am I going to afford school? I don't even know if I can with all these OSAP cuts, with all of these different stressors in the economy. How can I even think about getting to the point where I'm getting a job or so much as even buying a house? So there was a lot in there.
Yeah, those are big issues.
Yeah.
Complicated issues. What does research tell us about the world that these young people are walking yeah. into?
Well, there was a lot. And part of the issue I had with reporting it was like unpacking it all into one article because, you know, you look at the world that these kids are walking into. The world is on fire, quite literally, at their feet. Precarious work is a huge issue for them. 1 in 10 Canadians, I believe StatsCan most recent report said, are part of the gig economy. And precarious work isn't just gig work. It can present as contract work or part-time work, but there's just an increasing amount of this non-secure lifestyle that they saw their parents have. There's also the retreat of democracy that we're seeing, fake news, you know, just social media, technology, all of these different things. It's a cacophony of things just being shoved down these kids' throats. So it's a lot that's to unpack for someone who's, you know, this vulnerable age group who are now between the ages of 8 and 23 to have to accept and just digest and be like, okay, well, maybe I won't be able to get a job and maybe I won't be able to afford a house. And all of those things that basically secured having good quality of life aren't going to be attainable.
Well, I was talking about it with other producers on our team, and a lot of them expressed that they had feelings of anxiety when they were in high school or university, but it wasn't about these like big issues. Mm-hmm. It was about things that were kind of in their control, like their friendships or short-term goals, like, you know, what university am I going to go to or what job am I going to get or what skill am I going to go into, like that kind of thing. So what makes the situation for Gen Z so different? Why are they concerned with these big issues?
I will say that I think technology definitely is playing a large role in it. Part of the qualms I have with like pointing our fingers right at technology to be the thing that's causing this is it's sort of a knee-jerk reaction to say, oh, you know, phones and cell phones and social media are causing all these woes in our youth, because that sort of rationale has been applied to previous generations when, you know, TV was causing it.
We always point our finger at
exactly
social media or digital world.
For sure.
Yeah.
But I definitely think it plays a role. And I was speaking with a researcher in the United States who sort of studies the role of technology in family life.
Okay.
And she was explaining how not just the technology, but the way the information, the sheer quantity of information that is just constantly available at your hip and just a moments away versus previously when you could kind of choose to not be turn the TV on or you could choose to have the radio off. That's not an option so much for teens.
Yeah.
The other thing that I'll point out that in some of the feedback that I receive from just readers who are of those generations, you know, the boomers, the Gen Xers, they were pointing out how the stressors that they were dealing with was like, okay, it's Cold War. We need to do a rehearsal for bombs possibly falling on our school, so let's hide under our desks. But even they conceded that they didn't feel anxiety in the same intense ways that the teens in the article expressed. And I can't say that I have an answer for that, but I would say, or I would suggest perhaps, that just the quantity of information that they're receiving and the access to it, and it's just always on. A child psychologist I was speaking with said part of the problem is also, you know, kids are spending between 8 to 9 hours sometimes on their phones a day. That's in addition to going to school. So that time has to be made up elsewhere. So they're cutting back on their sleep.
Right.
And for young people, your sleep, you can survive without a lot of sleep and function fairly normally, but it starts eating away at your well-being in ways that you may not be cognizant of.
Fair.
So you have these vulnerable teens who are just sleep deprived. They're seeing all these bad things. So they might react more intensely to them than they previously would have if they were, you know, well slept. Plus right. other factors, of course.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Well, one of the experts you spoke to talked about resiliency, mm-hmm. and I thought that was really interesting. Can you talk about what she had to say about what role resiliency plays in the problem?
For sure. That was a topic I kind of wanted to go a little deeper on, but because of space limitations, it only ended up being 2 short lines or something. Her name was Dr. Laurel Johnson. She was describing how parents who were previously anxious growing up, say they were growing up in the 70s or 80s, there wasn't the same language, there wasn't the same awareness, stigma was up, so people weren't necessarily even aware that they themselves were anxious. Whereas nowadays, those parents have the awareness of, oh, there's anxiety out there, I don't want my child to suffer the same anxiety that I suffered growing up, and so that then they will sort of go and try to prevent the things that they think will make their child anxious or, you know, take down the barrier. So those resiliency building tools such as, you know, losing at sports or getting on a team or getting a role in a play, they'll make sure and intervene in different ways to make sure that their child doesn't have to experience that sort of loss. But those are resiliency building tools. And she sort of described the different people call it different things, the helicopter generation.
I was going to say, enter the helicopter parent, you
know? Exactly, yeah. Someone called it lawnmower parenting.
Oh, I haven't heard that one.
I hadn't either, but I was like, I get it, I guess, kind of. But yeah, so she was explaining how these parents are sort of taking away the tools that build those resiliency, and then when they're put out into the world, specifically in university, because a lot of teens, even one that I spoke to, she was saying that she never experienced anxiety growing up. But then once you got to university, you have all these like very intense stressors and you're kind of forced to do it on your own. You don't have your parent necessarily holding your hand through the experience.
Yeah.
You don't have the tools to sort of, you know, deal with it in a healthy way. So anxiety can kind of become this inheritable trait from your parents that you're not even really aware of.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And any of the people you spoke to, did they have any hope about the future? Like Greta Thunberg is a perfect example of someone who's taking action and turning like a negative situation into a positive one and promoting change and encouraging hope.
Mm-hmm.
Were any of these young people hopeful in any way or using this in a positive way?
I would say 50% or maybe more than 50%. That might be too negative. There was one teen who I spoke to. She's a climate activist. And her name's Isabella, and she's very, very positive. She wants to go into politics. She wants to change the world. And even as she's saying all these, like, as I'm interviewing her, she's describing all these factors. I'm never going to be able to afford a house. I'm never going to be able to pay off my debts. She hasn't even entered university, and she's already concerned about her debts. I'm never going to be able to stop climate change. Even though she herself is a climate activist, she recognizes that there's just something that she can't do, but there's still this optimism to make a difference as much as possible. And she was describing how, I can't remember the exact figures that she used, but the few women who are represented in politics nowadays, and she's sort of looking at that as like, it's a negative, but I want to turn it into a positive because I'm a woman, young woman, and I want to go into politics and I want to make a change. So I think there is definitely optimism out there. And there was also some really great groups that I found when I was originally sourcing the piece. I was reaching out to university groups.
Mm.
And a lot of these groups were just started because they realized that there weren't enough resources on campus. And so they were coming together to be like, what can we do as university students so that we don't have to see another one of our students suffer? There was this one group specifically that was started after a student at the, I can't remember the university, but after a student had taken their life by suicide. And they started it as a response to that, just to be like, hey, this is a support group. We can talk about these things. And then it's since evolved into a group to deal with stress at school. So it's interesting to see how, you know, even in the face of all this adversity and terrible things in the news cycle, people are finding ways to make something positive out of it.
There's hope.
Yes, yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit more about what resources are available for these people? Most of them are students. Are the universities or colleges or high schools that they're at, are they helping them in any way?
So the resources was an interesting sort of area because there are initiatives for sure out there. Part of the problem, after I spoke to Kim Moran from the Children's Mental Health Ontario, and she was describing how they're seeing a huge increase in help-seeking behavior. So they're seeing more and more students and young people reach out for help, which is, it could be read as a negative, but it could also be seen as more people are aware of the resources available to them. There's less stigma. More people are reaching out. That's a good thing, and if you look at it that way.
But it highlights the lack of support, right?
Exactly. So she was describing how they're having this increase in people with anxiety and mental health disorders. They're also seeing an increase in help-seeking behavior. But at the same time, they're seeing crunching of resources. I know Doug Ford recently, he cut funding for mental health from the previous government's 10-year commitment of, I believe, $3.4 billion to $1.9 billion. Though last October, he did increase this education minister, increased funding for students for $40 million, I believe. That's still an overall decrease of mental health funding. And Canada as a whole does not contribute as much as their OECD partners to mental health funding. For instance, 7.2% of our public health care funding goes towards mental health versus the UK where it's 12.2%.
Okay.
And there are resources on campus, but I think all campuses will admit that they are overwhelmed. There's countless articles out there attributing to the desperate wait times that students are on. One of the girls I was speaking to for this piece, she was describing how if you want emergency care, you can usually get it day of. If you want long-term counseling, however, you can be put on wait lists for up to 9-18 months, which is not helpful in any respect, especially when it comes to mental health care. It needs to be something that's attended to quickly. And if you attend to it quickly, then it prevents long-term or doesn't prevent, but it helps prevent long-term repercussions for people. Community counseling as well is a resource for young people. That, again, has also lost a lot of funding recently. And waitlist times, I know in Ontario, can be up to 18 months.
Hmm.
And most of those people seeking resources is for long-term counseling and intensive counseling. And, again, you can't be on an 18-month waitlist for something like that.
Lately, you know, we talked about this on our podcast. Mm-hmm. We've been seeing generations being, you know, pit against each other. Boomers versus millennials, mm-hmm. Millennials versus Gen Zs.
Totally.
What can other generations do to help support Gen Zs in their struggle with anxiety instead of, you know, chalking it up to just a young person's problem?
I think that was something that I was really just like afraid of when publishing, was people over the age of 45 looking at it just being like, this is teen angst.
Right.
Get over it. We had to, like, you know, walk 30 miles in the snow, uphill, whatever, that sort of logic. But no, I think millennials are probably the most likely to identify because they themselves are probably experiencing very similar woes right now. So I think just acknowledging that whatever they're feeling is probably magnified for the people who have grown up their entire lives in this current climate we're existing in. And for the older generations, I think just one of the problems, I think, when we talk about generations is that it is helpful for exploring trends, but it can be reductive in the sense that we just look at people as Gen Z, boomer, millennial.
Yeah.
And you get those okay boomer slogans going. But I think just if you literally just sit down and talk to a person and just extend some empathy for their situation, both with millennials, Gen Zs, and Gen Zs to boomers, you'll realize that when they're saying things like, okay, boomer, they're saying it's not fair that I don't have the same luxuries that were afforded to you growing up, and vice versa, when they sit down and talk to you, they'll probably explain, well, it's not fair now that I'm old and I can't afford to retire. So these same economic and sociocultural woes are happening to all of us. It's just affecting us in different ways. So I think it's the first step is just acknowledging that and then just taking them as people and not just, you know, Gen Z.
Thanks, Johanna.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Johanna Chisholm is a digital producer at the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story. For more from us, visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And of course, we are wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, why not give us 5 stars? We would really appreciate it. I'm Stephanie Phillips. Thanks for listening.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.